So my collaborators on this work are Per Cross and Nick Warner. I must begin by saying that a shorter version of this talk was given at Strings, and it took me half an hour, but I spoke very fast, and everybody told me, just give the same talk and speak slower and everything will be fine. So I'll try to listen to that. So I'll begin by motivating and my work and reviewing a few key aspects of what I'll be, which are needed to understand what I'm talking about. I'll then explore the deep brain physics behind the existence of three charged supertubes and black rings. I'll then talk about geometric transitions and the way to get microstate geometries from black rings. And then all the way through the talk, both at the beginning and at the end, I'll discuss some applications of this work for black hole physics. And there's a quite a rather large community working on this kind of issues, black rings, supertubes, microstates of black holes. The last paper appeared a few days ago, and the list keeps on growing. So we are. So again, this is quite. I mean, there's quite a large number of people exploring those issues. So let me begin by reviewing this object called the two-charge supertube, which was found by David, who is here, and Paul Townsend. So if you take some fundamental strings and take some D0 brains and you sprinkle them along these fundamental strings and you give the system some angular momentum, it actually puffs up into a configuration which has D2 brain dipole moments. So the D2 brain geometry is, the D2 brain is, has one direction along the direction of the fundamental strings and another direction is wrapping this closed curve. And interestingly enough, this closed curve can be of any, can have an arbitrary shape as long as it's closed. And despite that, the configuration has 8 supersymmetries, and moreover, they are the same supersymmetries as the ones of the component brains. So actually, the D2 brains do not affect the D2 brain dipole moment does not affect the supersymmetry or the mass of this system. And again, this is quite it's a bit counterintuitive. For example, you can have a D2 brain in, going in one direction and of the curve, and then the other one going in opposite direction, and yet the configuration is supersymmetric. And there's a huge number of those objects. They have many, many shapes. And if you can dualize them to different duality frames. You can go to, you can dualize, for example, four times, and you can get D4s and F1s popping out into D6s, or D0s and D4s popping out into an NS5. If you dualize this latter configuration, we get D1, D5 popping out into a Kaluza-Klein monopole. And those solutions in this particular duality frame, when you have D1, D5, and with the Kaluza-Klein monopole dipole charge, are actually smooth solutions which have no horizon. Those are, again, found, I mean, they can be found by T-dualizing the solution for those, or they're also found by some, using some other methods. And those solutions were shown to be dual to the microstates of the D1, D5 system. This has been some work which has been done by Matur over the past maybe 4 years, and it's quite a heavy amount of work. And if you count those guys, if you count actually the different shapes corresponding to those guys, you actually get the entropy of the D1, D5 system. You get actually this particular number, which is the entropy of the D1, D5 system.
And it's an arbitrary curve, so how do you count arbitrary?
There are some ways of counting which involve, so for example, you can count them using the Born-Infeld action, which lives on this D2 brain. You can take the Born-Infeld action, and you can quantize, you can actually make it time-dependent, you can quantize the mode, and you can actually... you end up writing a Cardi formula. You actually have 8 fields, and you can think about the shapes as coming from some wave packets living on this word volume, and then you can quantize this shape in a Cardi formula, and you can get this answer. So there are ways of, I mean, this is one way of doing it. In classical supergravity, there's a continuum of solutions, but one needs to quantize them. And I think right now, Don Marolf and Amitabh are working on methods of quantizing. So those are, again, counted using some Born-Infeld action or some FP string action. But I think there are, I mean, Don Marolf, who is, you know, he and his students, Amitabh, are working at methods of quantizing just solutions given by several sets of functions. So there's work in progress about counting more general things. So again, if you count those guys, you get this entropy, which is again quite sizable. So you get the entropy of the D1, D5 system. But the D1, D5 system, as people probably know, is not a black hole. The entropy of the D1, D5 system is not macroscopic. The D1, D5 system does not have a macroscopic event horizon. However, a very nearby system, the D1, D5P system, is a black hole. The entropy is given by this formula. It's the classical Schrödinger of alpha C charge black holes. And the question is, can we extend this story from the D1, D5? Can we extend the success of the D1, D5 story to the D1, D5P system? If we can, then we'll have actually a pretty interesting implication. The ADACFT is going to imply something quite interesting. On one hand, we have the boundary. So this is again on the CFT. This is in the bulk. And by the summation of alpha story, you know that the states on the boundary are counted by the black hole. If you compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, you get the entropy of the ensemble. And on the boundary, you also have the individual states. And the question is, can we find a geometry which has no horizon, like in the D1D5 case, for each of those states? If we can find a one-to-one map between here and here, which is again what this work is concerned about, then ADS-CFT implies something very interesting and strange at the same time. It implies that the black hole is more like the ensemble of some geometries without horizon. So in a sense, you have this huge number of geometries. If you count them, you should find the entropy of this three-charged black hole. Again, this hasn't been done, but this is what we are heading towards. And basically, those geometries have no horizon. They have black hole size, and they have black hole properties. So in a sense, it is like going from describing the air in this room in terms of thermodynamics to saying, oh, the air is made of some molecules. They are in some ensemble. If you zoom in, you'll find molecules zooming back and forth. The statistical features of these geometries are the same as the ones of the black hole, the absorption and the presence of a horizon and so on and so forth. But if you actually look at the actual macrostates, there are going to be some geometries which have no horizon. So again, this is a rather, if this is true, it would be quite a large jump in our understanding of black holes. One thing which we'll do would be, for example, to resolve the information paradox. It might also allow us to derive holography from string theory in a very natural setting. So those are, again, are very heavy goals. And if we can actually push in this direction to establish if this link is actually here, I think it's quite important. So that's, again, the big carrot in front of us. But before getting there, we need to do some... Sorry?
Consistency checks. What type of consistency?
So first of all, those geometries are not known. Until 6 months ago, the only three-charge geometries which had no horizon, which were known, were basically spectral flows of two-charge geometries. So those geometries are very hard to build, and I'll tell you in a while why. I mean, they cannot actually be built by normal techniques, and they have a very weird structure, which, I mean, it's quite hard to arrive at. So first of all, those things need to be constructed. Once you construct them, for example, you can count them. So for example, if you find that they're given by some functions of several parameters, one can apply similar methods to the ones used for the supertubes to count them. And if you get this entropy, then you are done. I mean, there's no... Otherwise, another thing which can be done also as a consistency check is to map the geometries which we have right now with the CFTs, is to make this map really precise. And in the CFT, you know how a generic state looks. You know that, for example, a generic state in the D1D5T CFT looks like a long effective string which has momentum modes running on it. And you can, for example, look at the type of geometries which are dual to those kind of states, and you can find if they have black hole features. For example, one thing which I'll talk about is, for example, I mean, the black hole size grows with this string. This is very unnatural. Most of the objects in the world, if you increase gravity, they shrink. The black hole becomes bigger. Those guys should become bigger as well. So there are all these checks which one can do. So let me get into the meat of the subject. So what's the way to get... the most obvious way to get three-charge solutions is to generalize the Matteo-Townsend supertube to solutions which have three charges. So you just take a two-charge supertube with D0F1 and D2 dipole charge. You take another one with D4F1 and D6 dipole charge. You take another one with D0D4 and NS5 dipole charge. D0F1 and D4 are the same as D1D5P, so they're actually mutually BPS. They preserve four supersymmetries. And you basically figure out that a supersymmetric solution should have those three charges and those three dipole charges. And Per Krauss and I have been able to find a Born-Infeld description for the ones which have two dipole charges and three charges. And we also found that, like the two-charge supertubes, those guys also have an arbitrary shape. And there's also a very large number of configurations, which is given by seven functions of one variable. So there's, again, a huge number of those solutions. They have three charges, so they actually are dual to microstates of the three-charge system. And, for example, so those are, again, some... This is, again, a D-brain description of those three-charge objects. If gravity gets stronger, for example, you can compare the size of those guys to the size of the black hole. You can compare the growth of those guys with G-string to the size of the black hole, and you actually find that the size of both grows up in the same way. So this is a very non-trivial consistency check. If those objects didn't grow at the same rate, if this grew with like GS squared, for example, then the whole Matteo conjecture would have been thrown to the trash. Because, I mean, you cannot... if this is true, it's true for all values of G-string. I mean, if this picture of black hole is true, it's true for all values. It cannot be true only at a certain point in the moduli space. And this is actually one of the things which we started to... I mean, this is one of the things which we wanted to used to disprove the matter conjecture, and things came out at the same rate. And it's again quite non-trivial. I mean, if I make gravity stronger, this desk is going to, I mean, everything becomes smaller usually. So it's quite non-trivial that as gravity becomes stronger, those guys also become larger. Now, you can also look at those objects, and you can look, for example, at their angular momentum. And what you find is that their angular momentum can be much bigger than the one the black hole can carry. The D25P black hole has an upper bound on the angular momentum, which is given by this formula, square root of N1 and 5 times NP. So this is the biggest black hole you can form in this theory. However, if you look at those supertubes, those which are supertubes, there's quite a huge number of supertubes which have J much bigger than this value. And in that paper, Per Krauss and I conjecture that those are going to be dual to the microstates of some black rings, which again should be BPS. Now, when we wrote that paper, the second day, we got some really angry emails from people who do black rings for a living, saying, "You ignorance, don't you know black rings, BPS black rings don't exist in five dimensions? There's a theorem." And we're kind of taken aback. We didn't know if things are. We didn't know exactly what is going on. Well, soon enough, after some more work, this theorem was actually found to be wrong, and it had a gap, and actually the black rings did exist. And U1 cross U1 invariant ones were first found by for equal charges by a collaboration which involves the people who have been here or are here, Henriette Elvang, Nevin Mateos, and Harvey Rial. And then the three dipole charge general solutions were found by, again, those people and this other people in the collaboration. So those are, again, U1 cross U1 invariant solutions, and they are like nice black objects, and I'll talk about them in a while. However, I'll tell you about the way to get the solution for a generic brain configuration. So again, in the U1 cross U1 invariant case, things are much easier. You can use some, the solutions can be found quite easily. However, if you want to get a solution for a generic brain configuration, it's going to be quite complicated. And for example, Samir Mathur tried in a paper to get these solutions, and after like about 20 pages of algebra, he came up with a three-page long formula, and this is again just a perturbative expansion around the two-charge solution. So again, those solutions are quite hard to get, and if you try to use the usual supergravity some techniques to generate solutions like boost, rotate, t-dualize, boost, rotate, and so on and so forth, it doesn't work. You get nowhere. I mean, you basically there's no way to approach this family of solutions by just usual techniques, which, I mean, they're good techniques, but they don't work in this case. So what do you do? Well, if you live in Los Angeles, there's a very easy solution. You get into the car, you go on Highway 10, and you drive to USC. And people at USC, like Nick Warner and Pilcher and Emeshansky, have been developing some techniques over the past several years to do much harder stuff. To attack, for example, the Pilcher-Warner solution, which has killing spinners which change with radius. And, I mean, those are like very hard problems. But they had the methods, so we basically used those methods. And the key idea used again was the fact that the dipole charges, again those the dipole charges of the supertube do not affect the supersymmetries. If you know that, then the killing spinners are the same as the ones of the normal brains. Once you know the killing spinners, you have the supergravity equations. Bang, you write an ansatz, and the solution just falls into your laps. At the level of the complexity of USC people, this felt like killing a fly with a cannon, because, I mean, again, they can do much more difficult stuff. But since it worked, we didn't object. So I'll tell you the form of the solutions for a solution where I have dualized things. I have put the three charges on. I have gone to a duality frame where the three charges D1, D5, and P all became some M2 charges in these directions. Again, in this version, the solution is much more symmetric and looks much nicer. And the dipole charges are again these three M5 brain dipole charges. So again, you have three M2 brains wrapped here, here, and here, and then you have the M5 brains which are wrapped on some toroid, and they also are wrapped on this closed curve which gives you the shape of the supertube. Yes.
So when you talk about the D brain description, you only yes. have two dipole charges.
Yes.
Now in supergravity, you're just going
to. In supergravity, I can put three or I can put two. It's up to me. So we actually have solutions for two dipole charges as well. It's not. It's quite easy to. I mean, the solutions are quite easy to cut down to one charge. I mean, so the charges can have any values. So in a sense, we can turn off one charge or we can put it on. And we can, for example, go to the Mateos Townsend supertube by just killing this M2 brain and killing this and killing this, and we just obtain the usual solution for the Mateos Townsend supertube. So. The killing spinners are not affected by the dipole charges. If you look at the killing spinners, they are exactly the same killing spinners of the normal M2 brains. They have the same components, like 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Even if they dominate the metric, the supersymmetries are not affected at all. And you can find, for example, if you take the two-charge supertube of Matteo 1000, you can put a probe before brain, which is, again, a mutually BPS with the brains which make the supertube. You can put it anywhere, it's going to be BPS. It feels no force. So it's, again, I mean, it's quite remarkable, again, as Gary was saying, that the dipole charges dominate the geometry, especially near the tube. But the brains are just happy to move back and forth.
So how many supersymmetries do you
have? Four. So this is a system of, I mean, the D95 system or a system of 3M2 brains like this has four supersymmetries, and if you add the dipole charges, nothing changes. So, and again, this can be any arbitrary closed curve. I mean, you give me any Mickey Mouse shape, I write a solution has four supersymmetries. So there's, again, huge, I mean, again, this is, again, the deep brain physics behind those, and it's quite remarkable. And, I mean, again, the fact that they came out in supergravity was not, I mean, it was nice to see them coming, but we knew, again, from the deep brains that they should be out there.
So that you brought the Anaheim, right?
Sorry?
You brought the Anaheim.
That's right. So basically, the way to get a solution is, again, you look at the supersymmetries and you, for example, ask that the M2 brains feel no force. You write some ansatz for that. And the solution, again, has three warp factors, one corresponding to each type of M2 brains, this blue one, the green one, and the red one, and also has some electric fields, again, corresponding to the M2 brains, which are, again, the normal electric fields of M2 brains in an M2 brain solution. Now, if this vector K were not here and I only had the first two lines, this would just be a normal Coulomb branch solution of which we know and love. However, In the presence of M5 brains, those M5 brains source some other fields. They actually, I mean, so for example, there's a field which has two legs on the directions 1, 2, and two legs in this R4 base. So this gives you effectively a 2 form in this R4 base. And there are three of them, this one, and this one. And they actually measure the M5 brain charge of this tube. And those are, again, magnetic, four forms. And the solution depends, again, on those three two forms, G1, G2, and G3, on the functions Z1, Z2, and Z3, and on the vector K. So that's, again, the ansatz which you write. And once you bang the Killing spinners, you find that the solution actually has four layers. First of all, you have the base, which is basically we took to be R4, but in general, it can actually be any hyperkähler four-dimensional space. It's quite simple to see why it should be hyperkähler. The connection has to be self-dual. And if you look in the supersymmetry equations, the connection enters, it acts on the Killing spinner. So let's say you have the connection, let's say omega 1, 2 equals omega 3, 4. Then you have the combination gamma 1, 2 plus gamma 3, 4 appearing in the supersymmetry equations. That just becomes 1 plus gamma 1, 2, 3, 4, which is what kills the Killing spinner. So any self-dual connection gives you, so self-dual connection on the base is needed for supersymmetry. Then you have the field strength, those Gs, which also need to be self-dual, basically for the same problem. They enter in the supergravity equations as G1, 2 plus G3, 4. So their components must be equal in order to give a projector which kills the Killing spinner. And then you also have some warp factors. And the warp factors satisfy this equation, D star DZ equals G2 wedge G3. This is for Z1. And then D star DZ2 equals G1 and wedge G3 and so on. Now, those of you who are familiar with Klebanov-Strassler will say, hey, I've seen this before. In Klebanov-Strassler, you have a six-dimensional transfer space, and you have a self-dual, imaginary self-dual three-form, and the equation is d star dz equals g wedge h. So again, and then you also have star of g equals 2h. So until here, the solution has the same structure as Klebanov-Strassler, and so again, if you see this kind of, it's quite similar to that. The only difference is that here we have this appearing three times. We have once for Z1, once for Z2, once for Z3. And then if you look at the rotation vector K, it satisfies this particular equation. And the interesting feature of those is the following. If you solve the system in this order, first get the base, then get the dipoles, then solve for the Zs, then solve for the Ks, the system is linear. At each stage, you have to solve a linear equation. This is linear, this is linear, this is linear. The result of the second step comes in the third step as a inhomogeneous right-hand side, but the equations that you have to solve are still linear. So that's, again, something which we found. I must say that this system has also been found in work on five-dimensional supergravity by those people, but they thought it was non-linear because it came in some in a very strange packaging. But using Killing spinners, I mean, in our case, it just came naturally in this in this form, and it just is something which helped us to realize it's linear. So so what's the way to find a solution? Again, those are the equations. Choose an M5 double profile, anything you want. It doesn't look too much like a Mickey Mouse, maybe like an amoeba. But and then you find a self-dual GIs sourced by those guys. It's just a typical, just an electromagnetism in four dimensions. At step number two, you sprinkle some M2 brain charges and you solve for the harmonic function. So you have some some of this Z is sourced by the actual M2 charges sitting on those objects, and some of it is sourced by this G solved at step one. And in the last step, you just find this vector K. Again, you invert this equation, and this is basically as simple as electromagnetism in, or as complicated, depends on your perspective, as ENM in R4. So implicitly, I can write down any solution, any shape you give me, any distribution of charge we want, I can write a solution. Now, implicitly, again, this is what's happening. However, if you want to actually have a closed form solution without ugly integrals floating around, it's much easier to concentrate on some symmetric cases. And the Yuan cross Yuan case is the easiest, and I'll talk about it. However, I would say that in the past year we have been able to go beyond the Yuan cross Yuan beyond cases with Yuan cross Yuan symmetry. We actually have cases which only have one Yuan, which is not even triholomorphic. That's something which.
Welcome. You are insisting on having a
The curve needs to be closed because it's charged under this vector charges, G. So if it's not closed, then this charge is not conserved. Self-intersection, again, generically, this is a closed curve in four dimensions. So generically, it doesn't self-intersect. So for generic microstates, you can say that it doesn't self-intersect. If it self-intersects, we haven't looked at the solution. If David has looked around, other people who work on those things have looked at solutions with self-intersection. Physically they should be okay, but we just haven't. Again, from the deep brain physics, you can take this thing to be any curve, any shape you want. You can just modify the shape as much as you want without anything drastic happening. So they might be okay, but we haven't looked at the solution. And
they can be more singular. Yeah. It certainly mm-hmm. be more singular. Mm-hmm. Isn't the topology of the space R4 minus this curve, or what is the
mm-hmm.
geometrical?
Mm-hmm. You write a curve in R4, you solve those equations in this particular order, and then you get a solution. So now you can ask, now in the case when you have a black ring, for example, effectively you have a horizon sitting here, and in the Yuan cross Yuan invariant case, this horizon is circular and smooth and happy and all that you want. So then you say the topology is actually, this curve has actually popped out into, has popped up, and actually the topologies are R4 minus a curve. But in terms of solution writing, and I'll show you later that actually the topology of the base will change in some other cases. So, but in terms of just physics, you have R4, you put a D-brain there. There's no. I think they are. They are sources for this harmonic function. I don't know, maybe.
The black ring case, there is a horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
So, but again, if you think about it without turning on gravity, you just have some D-brain which has a certain shape in space-time, and you just turn on gravity on that. So, there's a feeling in which, there's a sense in which the D-brain sits in the space, but as I'll show later, actually, there's a sense, once you turn on gravity, more complicated things happen. So let's just go through the first, through the most obvious and through the simplest example. This is just the black ring, which has three, which is U1 cross U1 invariant. It has dipole charges N1, N2, and N3, and it has also M2 charges, which I'm calling here N1 bar, N2 bar, and N3 bar. And you can give this configuration some rotation in the plane of the ring, and the solution again can be found by solving those equations or using some other methods. The entropy of the black ring is given by this long formula, and I'll have a surprise for you what this formula actually is. And if you look at the charges of the solution, if you look at the charges measured at infinity, they are equal to these parameters, N1 bar, which again I'll argue later that they're actually the physical M2 charges of the ring, plus this combination, N2 times N3, N2 is equal to N2 bar plus N1 times N3, and so on. And we interpreted this in our papers as coming from charge dissolved in fluxes. This is like in Klebanov-Strassler. If you look at the solution, there's a charge sitting at some point, but if you actually move your holographic spin further and further out, you'll actually see a different charge. So we interpreted this as being, this is just the charge sitting at measured at infinity, and this is the charge, the physical charge of the ring, and this is just contribution coming from the fluxes of the ring far away. In a similar fashion, the angular momentum has, so if you put the ring in the psi plane, the angular momentum has a contribution coming from the physical rotation of the ring, and also has another contribution coming from the supergravity fluxes. So again, the angular momentum also has a piece which comes from the supergravity fluxes, and a piece coming from the actual charges of the ring. Now, there are two ways to describe this ring and to actually look at the microscopic description. One of them is to take the the solution looks like you have a throat, and then you have some asymptotically flat part here, and then the ring sits at the bottom of the throat. So one way to describe this ring microscopically is to take a near horizon limit and to throw away the asymptotically flat region, and you zoom in on this whole region. In that limit, the solution is asymptotically ADST cross S3 cross T4. So the ring is an object in the theory, which in the D95 P CFT, the ring has D95 P charges at infinity. It's an object which lives in that CFT, and one can compute its entropy by looking at this D95 P CFT. And in the paper with Per Krause, I proposed a way to describe its entropy. I'll not go into it into much detail because of time. But there's another way to describe the entropy of this black ring. Instead of zooming on the whole throat region, one can actually zoom in on the near ring solution. And intuitively, what you get if you just zoom in on this near ring solution, you actually get a black string. The ring just looks to be infinitely long, and the solution is just the same as the solution of a five-dimensional black string, which is described in a 4D black hole CFT. So there's another description of the black ring using a 4D black hole CFT. Again, this is by zooming in this particular region of the geometry. There's one. So again, one microscope description, you throw away the asymptotically flat solution. The other one, you just zoom in on this region. Now, again, this is just nice and beautiful intuition. What's the way to actually make sure? I mean, what's the way to get this 4D black hole CFT picture established? One way to do it is to put the ring in Taub knot. And this is something which has been done by those people here. And if you put the ring in Taub knot, for one value of the moduli, you can have the ring to be deep inside. So Taub knot space is a space which is near the origin, looks like R4. And far away has topology R3 cross, looks like R3 cross cross S1. So if you basically look at the ring and put it in Taub knot, you can measure its, you can look at its features, and it does looks like the ring which I showed you before. However, if you change the moduli, if you actually change some sizes of the tori, and if you change the string coupling, the ring can migrate far, far, far away from this R4 region. And if you look at it, it looks exactly like a 4D black hole, which has charges N1 bar, N2 bar, N3 bar, N1, N2, N3, and JT. So, and once you realize that, you find that the microscopic entropy of the ring, this long formula, is nothing but the E77 quartic invariant, written in terms of those charges and some other charge which is actually zero. So again, by changing moduli, I can move this ring arbitrarily far away from this R4 point, and then it just looks, I mean, quarks like a 4D black hole, smells like a 4D black hole. The geometry is exactly that of a 4D black hole for 15 kiloparsecs around, and the microscopic entropy is that of the 4D black hole with these charges. I must say that there's another way to microscopically get this entropy by Michel Krier, Monica Guica, David Mateos, and Annie Strominger, which actually doesn't use those charges, the N1 bar, N2 bar, N3 bar, but uses the full charges of the solution, the one N1, N2, and N3. And that way gets, I mean, the description gives the same final result. They actually recover this, but not as an E77 invariant as a function of those charges, but as some using some other microscopic description, and it's actually quite puzzling, and I think it's something which is worth looking into why those two descriptions agree. Again, in this limit, when the ring sits far away, just looks exactly like a 4D black hole, and if you measure its charges, again, they're just the N1 bar, N2 bar, and N3 bar. So if there's a physical way to think about the charge of the ring, this is it. I mean, as you change the moduli, the charge of the ring cannot jump. N bars are quantized. As you change the moduli, the charge of the ring just remains the same. So there's a sense in which the charges are the N bars. However, if you, for example, try to write a charge integral which is conserved, you'll find that it's very hard to measure those N bars. So there's some So there's some tension between the microscopic description, which again uses the m-bars, and the charges which are measured at infinity, and those are, they're actually not equal. Again, Klebanov setting, Klebanov Strasser, those are cases where, again, this is happening, but until now there's no way to define just in pure GR to define those charges, to actually measure those charges which we believe sit on the ring. Now, this is, again, the way to microscopically describe the ring. However, I like, I mean, again, black rings are nice and we like analyzing them, but my main purpose is to actually give you microstates, to actually get solutions which have no horizon and which have black hole features and which have three charges. So what I want to do is to look at the solution which has zero entropy, which has S equals to zero, which is, again, my candidate for a microstate. If the entropy is bigger than zero, then I have a normal black ring, and if S is less than zero, then I have closed time like curves. The solution is unphysical and just throw it away. Now, the near horizon, I should have said the near ring metric in this case, is actually ADS3 cross S2 cross T6. So it's a nice near ring solution. And the horizon curvature can be actually made quite small. If you choose some big N1, N2, and N3, the curvature actually can be made arbitrarily small, and supergravity is happy. However, when S is equal to 0, the naive geometry, the one which you just take by putting the brains and computing a solution, is singular. And the singularity comes from having this ADS3 space with a compactive put in a box. Normally, when you put ADS in a box, you have a singularity because some S1 shrinks to zero size. And so again, we thought when we found the solution, great, we found the microstates. And this was actually last year in August. And then we say, wait a second, the microstates actually have this singularity. It's a mild singularity. So again, it's not a curvature singularity, but still, it's a singularity. So we want to actually get the physical microstates which actually don't have this singularity. How can we resolve it? There are two ways, and we actually attacked in both. In one direction, I attacked with Nick Warner, and the other one, I attacked with Per Krauss, each using the strength of each. So, so you can attack it on the supergravity side. You can just say, do you have a singularity which comes from some curve shrinking? We can think about it using geometric transitions. And this is one direction. The other one was actually to realize that, again, the near ring solution is just the 4D black hole. So then the singularity is the same as the one of the 4D black hole at S equals to 0. So, and that's something which can be analyzed in the 4D black hole CFT, and that's something which I have done with Per Krauss. So let me first talk about the way of resolving the singularity using geometric transition, and then I'll mention the other one a bit, and then I'll tell you how they meet. If there are any questions right now, I mean, it's a good time to, before I get into this, because this is rather gory. So it's not too gory. I mean, I have nice pictures, but okay. So what's the geometric transition? Well, it's a phenomenon which normally happens in string theory. Whenever you have some brains which wrap a certain cycle, which I'm denoting here with in blue, let's say you have those, and this cycle can be topologically trivial or topologically non-trivial. For example, in Polchinski-Strasser, you might have the brains puffed up by some flux. In some other cases, this might be a torus, so they actually might, this cycle can be non-contractible. But for now, let's put those brains on the cycle, and there's always a dual cycle, this thing which I'm denoting here with red, and if you integrate some appropriate form on this red cycle, you measure the brain charge. So you have some, so the red one and the blue one has linking, have a non-trivial linking. So again, if you integrate on this red circle, you measure the brain charge. Once you turn on gravity, deep brains in string theory have the tendency of shrinking the space they sit on along themselves. This is a feature of all the brain solutions. And once you turn on gravity, the brains shrink this cycle to zero size, and the dual cycle becomes large. And as a result, you have a solution which has a different topology and has no brain sources. The most classical example, Klebanov-Strasser, you put some fractional D brains which are defies wrapped on this S2. They source some F3, which is, so again, let's say in Klebanov-Strasser, this is going to be the S2 on which on the tip of the conifold. You have this S3, which now can shrink to zero size. And then the result, you have the exact solution is the Klebanov-Strasser solution, where the S3 cannot becomes large, and this blue cycle, the brains have gone from the space. So again, you start putting some brains in some space, you turn on gravity, and the solution which you end up with has a different topology and has no brain sources. How can we implement this here? Well, we have some N5 brains, which again wrap some S1 in this R4 base. There's a dual S2, and if you integrate, for example, this flux on the S2, you measure the dipole charge of the first brain. If you integrate it, if you integrate this guy on S2, you measure the second dipole charge, and so on. So we have an S1, which the M5 brains wrap, and you have an S2 which measures their charges. And again, once you turn on gravity, this S1 shrinks to zero size. Again, the flux where the cycle where the brain sits. And this is again what was giving us the singularity before. And the S2 becomes large. The S2 puffs up. And moreover, because the S1 is zero, so again, this S1 sits in some plane, and at the origin of the plane, this S1 also shrinks to zero size. So you have an S1 which is shrinking to zero size both here, and here, and you basically have a segment on which you have an S1 which shrinks to zero size at both ends, which gives you effectively a non-trivial two-sphere, which I'm denoting here with green. So because of this S1, and again, this is only happening because this S1 is topologically trivial. If it were not topologically trivial, then you will not have this green S2 being here. So again, after the transition, we expect to have a new solution, which has no brains, and has a new base. The base stops being R4, has something else, and has two non-trivial two cycles. One is like this red S2, which measures the brain charge. The other one is this green S2, which comes from this blue S1 shrinking to zero size at both ends. So that's again the expectation just using geometric transitions and just read Vafa's papers and look at a few cases, and this is actually what should come out of this setup. I must say if you look in LLM, a similar thing happens. You start with some giant gravitons, you turn on gravity and they actually shrink some cycles, and you can do a similar analysis. Actually our idea came after looking at LLM and seeing how the singularity of giant gravitons are resolved there, and then we said bingo, this is the same happening in our case. Can we find this base? Can we find this solution which has two non-trivial S2 and no brain sources and comes from the transition of the supertube? If I give you a generic supertube which has some Mickey Mouse shape, that's not enough information. The only thing which you know about the base is that it must be hyperkähler. Again, this is actually what came before from our analysis. If it's not hyperkähler, then it's not supersymmetric. So we expect this geometric transition not to break the supersymmetry. So again, for a generic supertube, this is not enough information. However, if the supertube is U1 cross U1 invariant, we can do more. There's a theorem by Gibbons and Rubach, which I hope to be true, which is basically saying that a hyperkähler space with U1 cross U1 isometries must be Gibbons-Hawking. So this is a theorem, and it's actually quite... and also it says that a hyperkähler case with the U1, which is tri-holomorphic, must be Gibbons-Hawking, and it has... they have a whole bunch of nice things in that paper. And what we want to use, so again, if we have U1 cross U1 invariance, we can actually do a bit more. We know that the solution must the four-dimensional space which results from the transition must be Gibbons-Hawking. Now, what's a Gibbons-Hawking space? It's a four-dimensional space which is basically coming from an R3 with this Wurf factor, and there's a fiber, and basically this vector A which appears here satisfies this equation, so it's a pretty simple four-dimensional solution. If V is equal to 1 over R, this is just R4 written in some funny coordinates, so this is something, you can just make a change of coordinates and recover R4. If V is equal to 1 plus 1 over R, you recover the top node space I was talking before about. So, for example, near R equals to 0, top node looks like R4. That's the statement which I made before. That's the way to see it. Now, when you have Gibbons, this V can have many centers, and between the centers, there are some non-trivial two cycles, and you can convince yourself quite easily that the fact that we have two non-trivial two spheres, an S2, the green S2 and the blue S2, implies that V has to have three centers.
Where is U1 cross U1 in
that other? There's a U1 from the fiber, so there's a U1 along psi, and there's another U1, so here actually is not enough, here you only have another, so the theorem says U1 cross U1 implies Gibbons-Hawking. But you can have Gibbons-Hawking which is not U1 cross U1. So again, the other U1, for example, if you take this V, the centers of this V to be collinear, then you have another axis of rotation in this base. And this is actually what, in the case of the supertubes which are U1 cross U1 invariant, we find that they correspond to some Gibbons-Hawking which are the spaces which are U1 cross U1 invariant. Again, one comes from the fiber, the other one comes from the axial symmetry along the direction of the centers. So again, having two non-trivial S2s means that V has three centers, and moreover, the charge of the centers has to be integer. Again, that's coming from this is just simple charge quantization. And moreover, the solution far away should be R4. We set it from an R4 base. We have some local phenomenon. This geometric transition happens locally near the ring. At infinity, the space should not change. So at infinity, I expect the metric to go to be asymptotically R4. So the sum of the charges should be equal to 1. At infinity, I should just see this function going like 1 over r. And the requirement of integer charges basically forces me to accept that V has to be equal to 1 over r minus k Q over RA plus Q over RB, where Q is an integer. So that's, again, this is the only way to get a hyperkähler U1 cross U1 invariant manifold, which has two non-trivial S2s. And I'll show later that this actually, so again, this is basically what geometric transition arguments and U1 cross U1 invariants force on us. And you can look at the solution, so you have a nice solution where you have the origin and you have the ring sitting at some point, and then you have the resolved solution where basically the location of the ring has resolved, has, I mean, basically, and the ring has been resolved by popping out, by the popping out of this red cycle, or otherwise by the nucleation of this Gibbons-Hawking plus minus pair. So you have here, you have Gibbons-Hawking charge 1 at the origin, you have charge minus Q at the position A, and you have charge plus Q at the position B. And so this is, again, the resolved solution. It has non-trivial topology, again, those two spheres. If you integrate this F, for example, on the AB sphere, on the small cycle, which is actually where the brains were, you get back the dipole charges. So that's, again, yes?
Sorry, so it looks like you get an extra parameter when you do this geometric transition, because Q is something in your base.
Right.
But does that actually have an analog in the parameters of the original black, the U1 cross U1 black ring?
Of zero entropy.
Parameters.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so you take the entropy equals zero subset, so that's still several parameters.
Actually, no, that's only one parameter. So this parameter is actually extra. This parameter between, I mean, the extra Q is an, I mean, this is an extra parameter. And
you have one more parameter.
You have one more parameter. Now, you should have more parameters, because if you look at the entropy, the only thing which you know is that the S equals to zero black ring doesn't have a macroscopic entropy. So, for example, if you look at a 4D black hole, if you turn off one of the charges, you end up with a three-charge system. The three-charge entropy is not visible in supergravity. It's not something which... So it looks like a zero-entropy configuration from the point of view of supergravity. However, there are some microstate solutions sitting there. So in a similar fashion, this Q parameterizes some microstates of the zero-entropy black ring. Also in Matur's case, for example, you have the D95P black hole. You take P to zero, you expect no entropy. However, you have all these two-charge supertubes. So... this is actually, but unfortunately, this is only one parameter, and there should be many more of those. So again, we have two non-trivial two cycles, this red one and the green one. If you integrate the fluxes on the red one, you get these n's, and if you integrate them on the green one, you get these other numbers f. And if you look at where the M2 brain charge comes from, you just find that the number of two brains of this form is equal to n1 times f2 plus n2 times f1. So you basically have the flux wrapping this cycle, wedge the flux wrapping this cycle, sourcing this harmonic function, and that infinity basically, this is the only way to get charge in a solution. So the whole M2 charge of this system is completely coming from fluxes. There are no brain sources. The brains are completely gone from the space. If you go away from this AB bubble, if you go here, the solution resembles the naive solution. You just recovered the naive solution. If the bubble is small, you get back to the singular solution. So again, this has all the features to be the geometric transition of the black. I mean, again, you recover all the physics you expect, and it's very similar to LLM. Those of you who have studied LLM, or for example this M2M5 polarization case, which is in the appendix of LLM, and which Nick and I have also studied before, will find exactly the same features, except that there you have some three spheres which shrink and form and give you four spheres and so on. Here I have two spheres, one sphere and two spheres. But it's, the physics is very, very similar. Now, I have this resolution mechanism, which again says that the black ring of zero entropy is resolved by the nucleation of a plus minus Gibbons-Hawking pair. How can I link this to the 4D black hole? Again, the way to do it is to put the ring in top knot, again, to change the moduli to basically kick it out of this R4 region and move it on the R3 cross S1 region. And the nucleation of a plus minus pair means that this ring, again, the top knot space picks up another plus center and another minus center. Now, when you compactify this down to four dimensions, this looks like the 4D black hole, which I had before, has split into two separate chunks of brains. Basically, the brains which form the 4D black hole has split into two separate chunks. And this is actually quite weird from a four-dimensional point of view. I mean, why would the brain be resolved? Why would the zero-entropy singularity be resolved by the splitting of the sources? But this is what comes out. Again, take the ring, put it in top knot, look at the singularity resolution, and you basically split the 4D black hole into two stacks of brains. Now, I'm a bit, I gave a few transparencies to the work with Nick. I'm only giving three lines to the work with Per, but this is actually much more complicated, but and that's why I'm not spending so much time presenting it. You can also analyze the D95 KK Kautsaka monopole P system, which is actually a 4D black hole, which has four charges. You can take P goes to zero, And then you'll get a zero entropy for the black hole. And you can actually analyze this using the CFT of this which describes this black hole. And what we found after a lot of work was that indeed that also the zero entropy for the black hole was resolved by the splitting of this D1D5 brains from the Kolmogorov-Klein monopole. So we found an identical resolution mechanism in the case of the zero entropy for the black hole. The zero entropy for the black hole is resolved by the splitting of the brains which make it into two stacks. And this is again matching with what the black ring does. And again, the resolution mechanism is the same. And we're quite happy that this whole thing worked out. Now, I want to tell you a few things about the solution. I talked about those things last week in the mathematician dialogue, because, I mean, those are things which I think mathematicians have a lot of input to bring us. If you look at the new base, you have a given Hawking space. Again, this is the metric. And this is the warp factor. And if you look near the place, near the origin of this term, when in the region where this guy dominates, the warp factor, V, changes sign. The signature of the base goes from plus, 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 plus here to minus, 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 minus here. Now, normally, if you find such a solution, you throw it away because you say this is a solution which has undefined signature, and normally you just throw this away. However, if you look at the full 11-dimensional solution, the harmonic function Zi also blow up and change sign at exactly the same point. As you remember, the Zi is satisfied this particular equation, and this star here is taken with respect to the base. And basically, this equation knows when the base is changing sign, and the Zi blow up at exactly the same point. Basically, Z goes like 1 over V times some stuff. And the full metric, the full 11-dimensional metric, is smooth. So those spaces, those hyperKalian manifolds which have patches of negative signature, they can be thought of as auxiliary spaces to construct a full smooth 11-dimensional solution. Now, if I take n supertubes instead of taking one supertube, which is again I can just take them to be concentric, if I look at the resolution of that situation, I basically get that each of them pops out into a plus minus Gibbons-Hawking pair. So I actually find the solution like that. This again has U1 cross U1 invariance, but I can break one of the U1s. I can actually let those guys move around on the base. And I can find that a generic solution just corresponds to putting a bunch of pluses, a bunch of minuses. The sum has to be equal to 1, hopefully. And you just sprinkle a bunch of pluses and a bunch of minuses on the base. You wrap some fluxes on the two cycles running between each of them. And this gives you a smooth 11-dimensional solution. And Nick Warner and I and Per Berglund and Eric Shimon and Tommy Levy have analyzed this, and also Amanda Pitt and her collaborators in this recent paper. And you basically get, again, smooth solutions which have arbitrary, I mean, just gases of a gas of plus and minus centers. There are also three other three-charge microstates which have been constructed by Giusto, Matura, and Saxena in a completely different fashion. They actually took a five-dimensional black hole in non-extremal, and they took a novel extremal limit of that five-dimensional black hole, and they found some of the microstates of this D1D5 system, which are spectral flows of trivial microstates, but still they're actually, I mean, their physics is, I think, is relevant for those cases. And what they found is that in their case, the harmonic, this V is equal to Q plus 1 over R minus Q over R. So their solutions are just a particular case of our solutions, where all the plus guys have gone together at this point, and all the minus guys have gone together at this point. So now we have three ways to argue that those solutions are the three charge microstates of the black holes. One of them is through geometric transitions. One of them is by looking at the S equals 0 for the black hole and the singularity resolution. The other one is by taking these novel extremal limits, and they all go to the same place. They all go to these Gibbons-Hawking manifolds, which have negative patches of negative signature, patches of positive signature, and the full 11-dimensional metric is smooth and happy. So that's basically, again, we have three routes of attack. I mean, they are completely different. I mean, this is just 4D black hole CFT. This is just geometric transition, and this is some limits of non-extremal solutions. I mean, they are completely different, and they all point to the same physics. Now, there are more general solutions. Again, what we have is just the U1 cross U1 invariant. If it's Gibbons-Hawking, it must have a U1. But we believe that there should be many more solutions, because those supertubes can have arbitrary shapes. And they can also have arbitrary M2 brain densities. So if you look at the generic supertube at an S equals 0 configuration, which you expect to have before the geometric transition, there should be six functions worth of those guys. There are basically, those are just some curves in R4. So there are four functions which describe the shape. And they also have three densities of M2 brains. And one of them, and you can ask the entropy to be 0, so this gives you a constraint. So we expect to have six functions worth of zero entropy guys, which by general geometric transition arguments should transition into six functions worth of hyperKalian geometries. Now, if you have n supertubes, which have six n functions worth of configurations, they should transition to an asymptotic L4 hyperkernel geometry, which has some patches of minus, 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 and minus signature, and there should be six n functions worth of those geometries. So there's a huge number of geometries out there. We believe, again, using our arguments and also using the fact that we know that supertubes exist in string theory and they are good, honest-to-goodness configurations. There's a huge number of geometries, we believe, out there. Again, we haven't found those. I mean, we only know the U1 cross U1 invariant ones and the ones based on a Gibbons-Hawking base. But we know that there is we expect to be a huge number of functions, and those are all geometries dual to microslits of the D15P black hole. So there's a huge number of geometries which are all dual to microstates of this thing. And if one counts them, they actually might be enough to count for the entropy of this black hole. I think Don and Amitabh are looking at some methods to count geometries knowing how many functions they depend on. And Radu and I are also analyzing perturbing around this Gibbons-Hawking. Radu Reban and I are also analyzing perturbing around this Gibbons-Hawking solution to find how many functions are there. So it's something which are in progress. And we might not get the full exact counting, but I believe if the number is large enough, I mean, if the number scales like e to the square root of n1, n2, n3, then it's going to be rather compelling argument that there's a huge number of microstates out there. So I want to end by discussing the implications of this work for black hole physics. I have written this graph. I hope everybody can see. I have given you this graph in the first at the beginning of the talk, where you have the bulk. And you have the boundary, and you have the black hole here, and you have the states of the boundary, and then you have the solutions, which are building here. And the link which I'm trying to establish is this one, and this is just statistical mechanics, this is Strominger Wafa. So again, the link which I'm trying to establish is this one. I'm trying to link each state to a solution, and then you have the solutions dual to the black hole. Now, another way to think about this system, if those things didn't exist, we wouldn't have a big crisis. Again, those things were not known until a few months ago. I mean, the generic, nobody knew that there are so many solutions. Another way to think about this correspondence is to draw a line like that. So one possibility for the physics of the D15P system is that the individual states of the boundary, those guys, are not dual two individual solutions in the bulk. This link doesn't exist. And the ADS CFT correspondence only relates the partition function of the bulk to the one on the boundary. And the states are just counted by the... So the partition function in the bulk includes the black hole, and the black hole just counts all those states. And all this corner of the diagram doesn't exist. So this is one possibility for the black hole physics of this system. Now, in red I have the counter-arguments. First of all, I have shown you that a huge number of D15P states have an individual bulk dual. There's a huge number of those geometries sitting out there. Why would some CFT states have a bulk dual, which is nice and smooth and happy, and some others be mapped together into a black hole? It's a rather unnatural distinction from the point of view of the CFT. Moreover, all the other systems where we have studied the ADS-CFT correspondence in gory detail, like LLM, giant gravitons, D15, Porchinsky's thruster, D4, NS5, they do have one bulk state for each boundary state. You look in the boundary, you find some vacua. You look in the bulk, you find some vacua. There's or some states. There's a one-to-one correspondence between them. So in all the other systems which we know, there's a one-to-one map between boundary states and bulk states. Why would this system be special? Why would this correspondence stop working in this particular system? So this is again one view of black holes, and one view of the black hole in this D15P system. And those are the things which. Those are some points to hit it. The second view of black holes is that indeed each boundary state has a bulk solution which is dual to. So this map exists. However, the microstate, the generic microstate which is dual to a black hole, has an entropy, has a horizon, and looks exactly like a black hole. Okay, maybe when you go close to the singularity, there will be some Planck-sized junk near the singularity which will be different, but each of the microstate is going to look exactly like the black hole. It's going to be very similar and indistinguishable in classical physics. The problem is that each microstate in this story has a horizon and has an entropy. And microstates should actually have no entropy. I mean, that's what being a microstate means. Moreover, we get back all the problems of black holes. I mean, the unitary problems. I mean, the Hawking information paradox and so on and so forth. So, the microstates, again, do not have unitary physics for the same reason for which the black hole doesn't. The third view, which again I believe just comes from extending from believing that this state to solution story, which happens in all the other cases, extends to the D5P system and which has been crystallized by Matur, is that each boundary state has a bulk dual, and the generic bulk microstate has no horizon, again to help unitarity, and is large, horizon size. Now, this is actually the third view. One thing against this is that, for example, if you take a collapsing shell and you let it collapse, it seems like it's going to give you the normal Schwarzschild solution. It's very hard to see how it will become one of those big puffy microstates. However, a non-trivial check which we performed, again, was looking at the size of those solutions, and the size grows with the black hole horizon. So, again, if those solutions correspond to the microstates of the CFT, then we have to believe the last one. But it's something which, again, I mean, they might not. I mean, I think the jury is still out there to decide which of those solutions is right. Maybe I've said that the Supreme Court is still out there, so hope. So again, those are the things which I wanted to let you with. So I have given, first of all, a description of the D-brain physics behind the existence of black rings and supertubes. I've shown you how to get supergravity solutions of arbitrary shapes. I've discussed geometric transitions and the ways to get microstates and that they correspond to these asymptotic R4 hyperkilo geometries with patches of minus signatures. And there should be 6 n functions of Worth-Drop geometries when you have n patches of minus signature. And those are, again, the things which came out from this physics. A few things which I'd like to know, a few things which I'd be quite happy if people have any hints and ideas. First of all, what's the classification of these hyperkilo metrics? Can we classify those solutions? I mean, again, mathematically, probably some mathematicians 50 years ago looked at them and said, those are garbage. I mean, they have changed signatures. So if there's some work on that, I would really appreciate knowing where to look for it, and if there's a way to classify them, count them, find how many deformations they have, find how many are there. The second, which is something which I think it's quite an attackable problem, is to find the CFT microstates dual to bubbling solutions. It's actually to make this map really precise in the case of the solution that we have and the state in the bulk. And, for example, one can ask, what are the supergravity features of a generic bulk microstate, which corresponds in the bulk to long effective strings? If you find that solution looks like, I don't know, some ugly, puffed-up configuration which has a whole bunch of cycles and so on and so forth, one can look at its features, because it's a generic state. So if a generic state should have black hole features. So, for example, one can look at the size of the horizon and compare it to the black hole. If it's the same, then I think we have a pretty strong argument that Matur is correct, and that's the way the black hole is. If it's not, then we just proved that it's wrong. So I think it's something which can be looked at, and I think, I mean, again, the work, it involves a bit of heavy work, but I think it's an attackable direction to find the exact CFT microstates dual to bubbling solutions, to get this map, in the cases we have, to make this link really precise. And again, the last one, which is, I think, the main thing, which of those three versions of black hole physics is correct?
So I think there's a fourth interpretation of all.
Oh, wow, okay. That's nice.
The one that I believe in wasn't listed.
Okay.
So, I mean, first of all, ADS CFT is the correspondence between the CFT and string theory in the space of mm-hmm. conscious gravity.
Right.
So I certainly agree that there should be a one-to-one agreement between states.
Mm-hmm.
Every distinct microstate of the CFT should have mm-hmm. a corresponding distinct state
Fair
in
enough.
The full string theory.
Mm-hmm.
But it could well be that when you sort of just restrict to a gravity description, you've already thrown away a lot of information. There's all these distinct mm-hmm. states of high energy strings,
mm-hmm.
which all basically produce the same long-range gravitational field. So if you insist mm-hmm. on describing it just by writing down the gravity solution or just mm-hmm. the metric, you necessarily have thrown away a lot of information.
Fair enough.
And so you could well get black hole-like gravity solutions mm-hmm. for all of the distinct microstates.
Mm-hmm. The question is, what's the size of those microstates? I think that's the main... because if those if those string configurations are small, and they behave as if they look like a point mass, and then or a point source, and then they source this gravity solution, then I think this is very similar to proposal number 2, that basically the solution is just the same as a normal black hole with a bit of Planck scale string information near the singularity, but the string information is quite small. If the string states are large, if they have horizon size, then the solution is just, there are two versions of the Matur conjecture. The first one is the strong Matur conjecture, which says all the microstates are supergravity solutions. The second one is the weak Matur conjecture, which I don't think can be disproved, which basically says the microstates are basically string configurations. But I think the key idea is that those things should be large, because if a microstate, if an object falls, hits this microstate, it should be absorbed. The same thing should happen as if it hits a black hole. So it should just go in and stay there for a really long time, thermalize, and then get spitted out as Hawking radiation. And this is something which, for example, can happen in those bubbling solutions. Something that may just fall in and spend a lot of time inside this messy topology, and then at some point get broken into pieces, and then at some point just get radiated away. And I think it's just, again, if it's a string configuration, then if it's just a solution of some, the solution might actually be part of those things. It might be just a version of the weak Matur conjecture, which. So I think it's, again, depending on the size of those objects, it might either fall into category 2 or category 3.
Even if the size is small and it's a category mm-hmm. 2, I guess I wouldn't agree with your objections, because microstates do not have unitary physics. Well, we believe the black hole evaporation is unitary. We may not understand exactly how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
We believe the evaporation is unitary, then there's no problem with unitary physics. And each microstate has a horizon. Well, it has a horizon in this coarse grained description if you look only at the gravitational field.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that each microstate has mm-hmm. to be something.
No, sure. I totally agree. There are honest to goodness objections against those objections, and people can argue the same thing. If I go to Stanford, I think people at Stanford, like Lenny and Steve Shankar, they believe in the first one. They believe that the black hole goes into, that this link is correct, and those things just are not part of. Those things are not generic. So they can probably shoot me with arguments in those. And Matur can give you really convincing argument that I can do collapsing shells and obtain those. So I think it's something which. But I think if we're able to do, for example, this thing which I'm saying on the last transparency, if we can actually find the features of states which are dual to generic microstates, to long effective strings, we can look at their features. We can just say, let's say I have a string, an effective string of length n1 and 5 over 2, it corresponds to something. n1 and 5 over 4, it corresponds to something else. And I can extrapolate, and I can see what I find. Do I get some Planck size form? Do I get more? Do I get something else? And I think it's something which it's within our reach. It's just that people need to actually sit down and look at this stuff. This is, again, hard work. Solution building in a sense is quite easy. This is actually really, really heavy, really, really heavy CFT. So I think if we do this, we'll be able to actually figure out if those are just string configurations or if they're actually much, much bigger gravity solutions.
Could it also be the microstate that describe the black hole? Since you're looking at the large charge limit, maybe mm-hmm. most of them, when you take that limit,
mm-hmm.
the ones that dominate the entropy are sort of classical. They have some classical description, but there are many others that are not don't have a classical mm-hmm. description that also contribute to the entropy, but you don't see it in the leading order in large charge.
So I can definitely give you some microstates which are just some string, which look to be quite stringy. They have large curvature and so on. So there are definitely lots of microstates up there. And moreover, there are microstates of black holes and there are microstates of black rings. You can also look at the sector of the CFT which has J bigger than square root of n1 and 5 times NP. And there you should have some other solutions which are actually black ring microstates and not black hole microstates. So it depends actually what. I can definitely see many of those solutions being singular or being just stringy. The question is, the main question is, how are the generic states looking like? This is actually the key question. Are the generic states which contribute to the entropy going to be smooth? Are they going to be large? Are they going to be foamy? Is the foam going to be Planck size? Is the foam going to be bigger than the Planck size? Is the entropy going to come from different ways of wrapping cycles, wrapping fluxes on this foam?
But all the calculation you did was with large quantum numbers, right? With large charges.
Yes, I'm looking at the supergravity solution. So again, it's all large quantum numbers. But they might again. But I think again, it's possible to relate the features of those solutions. If it's possible to relate those features to the features of the CFT, then we can actually know exactly what we are looking at. Are we looking at a generic state, or are we looking at some random weird state which doesn't contribute to the entropy?
Are these solutions stable?
Well, they're BPS. So I mean, one can actually start saying, oh, how is the Schwarzschild black hole looking like? And I mean, one can come with many questions. But I think, I mean, for now, my policy is let's do supersymmetry first. Let's go where we understand. Let's push as much in the direction we understand, and then people like Lenny Susskind can come and speculate and get all the physics of the Schwarzschild black hole. But I think the things that we can do right now are just those, and we can look at the supersymmetric solutions, and there we know things are stable, things are happy, and so on.
Well, thank you.